Ahoy, Mets fans. Welcome to episode 276 of Amazing Avenue Audio, the official podcast of your SB Nation New York Mets site, Amazing Avenue. My name is Brian Salvatore. Thank you for joining us this week for a show about how the Mets are good. The Mets are 10-1. The Mets have the best record in baseball. The Mets are in first place. The Mets are a balanced team that is doing... I mean, they're just doing so many things right now. It's great. It's been a really fun first 2 weeks of the season, and Chris McShane and I are here to tell you all about it. So here we go. So this is fun, huh?
Yeah. Welcome back.
Thank you. It's I was legitimately worried, and I am not a superstitious guy, but I was legitimately worried that my presence would somehow jinx the Mets into snapping this hot start, but I needn't have worried. The Mets are had the best record in baseball right now. They are 10-1. They have won 8 games in a row. They have swept a road trip of 6 games or more for the first time since 1991, according to the broadcast tonight. Everything is going well for the most part, with a couple of minor exceptions we'll talk about in a minute. When was the last time you remember feeling this optimistic about the Mets this early in a season?
I guess I'm going back to 2015, you know, just that winning streak. And we touched on it a bit last week, too, you know. But that was a legitimately fun thing. And it was kind of the same position we're in now. It was a little bit later in the season. You know, the season didn't start in March that year. Mm-hmm. You know, it was, I think, the third week of the season by the time they really had started racking up wins. But you had this similar sense of, hey, these are games that they can't have taken away from them. And, you know, to get this right off the bat is just, it's incredible. So on this particular date, I don't know if I've ever felt this good about a team. I guess 2006 started similarly, you know.
Yes.
Eight and one start followed by just complete dominance for the entire season.
Yeah, and then in 2007, I think we all believed that the team was going to go back to the playoffs, you know, not just that year, but for a couple of years, because the team seemed built for long-term success. So even if the record didn't reflect it at this point in 2007, I think I probably felt probably even more optimistic in April of 2007, just because we saw what this team could do in the... you know, the year before, and if just a couple of things had gone right late in the season, injury-wise, who knows what 2006 could have been for the Mets. So, in terms of optimism, I was probably pretty close in 2007. But what's so exciting about this for me is that, look, we know the Mets aren't going to win. You know, there was a sign of the game tonight, you know, it said, "Go Mets, 161-1. And while, you know, we'd all love to see that, that's obviously never going to happen. But what I think has been so refreshing is that first of all, the team is playing, to my eyes, just a much crisper version of baseball than they were playing the last couple of seasons. You can blame that on Terry Collins, or, you know, reward that on Mickey Callaway. There's a lot of reasons for all that. But the biggest thing to me is just that this team right now is looking so balanced. That's what has me so excited. It's not one player carrying the team right now. This looks like a team that is just very deep, and different guys each night are making it happen. The bullpens looks really good. There's just a lot to be excited about right now. And it's not, you know, this isn't the excitement that we had when Cespedes came over and carry the team for a month. You know, it's just a different level of excitement, and it's just so much fun.
Yeah, and to your point, you know, it's coming into today, you looked at it, and the bullpen had probably been the most outstanding. You know, I think they had the second or third best ERA among all bullpens in baseball coming into this game tonight. The starting rotation hasn't quite fired on all cylinders yet, but still came into it. I think they were 12th best in ERA and probably not at their peak performance yet. You know, Syndergaard and DeGrom have been fine. They've been good, but they haven't been the Cy Young caliber pitchers that we know they can be. And then the lineup came in maybe a little bit underrated. I think they were fifth best coming into tonight in weighted runs created plus. I know that's not everybody's favorite metric, but just an overall sense of how the team was doing, well balanced is the best way you can put it, you know. And even when you break it down into more detail among, you know, within each of those three main components of a team, you know, I think individual hitters, there were only one or two guys who had like truly struggled. You know, maybe a couple guys have been, you know, below expectation or whatever. But I think Reyes and Flores were the only guys who had terrible batting lines coming in. None of the starting pitchers have been awful, even though none have been dominant. You know, in the bullpen, what's the harshest thing you could say? Seawald has barely pitched, and you know, Rame has a little bit of a home run problem, I guess. Like, it's just, yeah, that is the best way I can think of putting it. And it gives you hope because you know some guys are going to struggle, some guys are going to get hurt, even if it's minor injuries. It's, you know, it's just something that happens over the course of the season. Yeah, this is a whole lot of fun.
And you know, to be honest with you, I don't care if it ever happens for Reyes. But what's been nice is seeing, like, you know, you mentioned Flores started the year off rough. Then last night, Flores had a really, really good game. And then tonight, you know, he also got a big hit that drove in a run. So you're just seeing everybody contributing a little bit, aside from Reyes. And like I said, I really don't care if it doesn't happen for Reyes. And that's that is partly personal, but partly just I didn't understand them bringing Reyes back. You know, there was some internal Slack conversation last night at Amazing Avenue about the sort of negative reactions some people had to the Asdrubal Cabrera deal that went away, you know, last night. And I think both of us were pretty pro Cabrera, even with the option being picked up this winter. But especially with the way everybody else is playing, it's really hard to make a case for Reyes to be on this team in the long term.
And I think defending Cabrera has been more or less the brand for me. And not that you haven't, but you know, he's been my guy. And may I just say that Hansel Robles, I never really doubted you. I was just, you know, I gave in. I gave in to Mets fans. Welcome back. I knew you had it in you.
If Mickey Callaway has somehow been able to identify, or Dave Island, to identify what makes Robles good versus not good, goddamn man, what can't they do then? If they can do that, what else can they do? It has been, it's just been a lot of fun, and I think that, you know, Callaway is getting a lot of credit for pushing the right buttons and all of those, you know, cliches about what managers do and during a game. But it really does seem like the coaching staff seems to be using players in really intelligent ways. There hasn't been a move yet that's looked really boneheaded. You know, there hasn't been a single Gabe Kapler-esque move yet. Obviously, you can argue with the way certain things have played out, or maybe you could say, you know, you wish he stuck with starting pitchers longer, something like that. But I mean, after 11 games, what's your general impression of Callaway?
I mean, it's been good. You know, it's hard to come away with any criticism when things are going this well. The only move that didn't really work was actually Robles coming in facing Bryce Harper in a game that was tied at the time. Mets came back as they have been doing regularly here, and made that not matter. And Robles pitched a great inning after that. But yeah, that's pretty much it. Man, I hate to even like I don't even want to say disappointed. I would enjoy on a night like tonight, Gesellman comes in and just mows down the Marlins in the eighth. Strikes them all out, all three batters he faced. I would have loved to have seen him also pitch the ninth.
I agree
This
with
is like,
that.
these are just minor things. Maybe coming off the extra inning game on Sunday night where Gesellman and Lugo went multiple innings. Callaway went into tonight and said, I don't want to do that to either one of those guys again if I can help it. If Wheeler had thrown 100 pitches in 4 innings, then, that probably changes the equation. But given the way it goes, I get it. But it just little things like that. I don't know. And I don't know how involved he was in the decision to bring Oswalt up and then send him back down and send Nimmo down in the process. Nimmo getting demoted is probably like my one complaint about the season so far.
Yeah, we should talk about Nimmo getting demoted in a second. But before I forget, I want to just briefly touch on Zach Wheeler's performance from tonight. Because I don't think anybody thought that Wheeler would have the first truly great start for a Met this season. He went 7 innings, gave up 1 run. Essentially, he threw a bad pitch that got a home run hit in the first inning. And since then, kind of cruised and looked really good. Did not seem to. And we have to also say, the Marlins lineup is not great, so it's not like this was not him going up against the 27 Yankees or anything, and being dominant. But the same lineup last night kind of ate up DeGrom, and he just looked composed and didn't throw 1,000 pitches to get a single out, as it sometimes feels like he does. It was just a really, really good start from Wheeler, and I didn't have much expectation for Wheeler going into the season, and one start is certainly not going to change that. But it just gave you an idea of what this team has in terms of pitching depth if everybody stays healthy. And that's, of course, the world's biggest if. But it was just so refreshing to see. He was missing bats, he was giving up weak contact, he just looked. I mean, this is the best Wheeler's looked. Gosh, I can't even remember the last time he looked this good. Can you?
I mean, it might have been in Miami in 2014 when he threw the shutout.
Yeah.
And this was pretty close. Obviously, he gave up the run early, so it ruled out shutout. But pretty close to that sort of dominance. He only threw 83 pitches in 7 innings. He strikes out 7 guys. He got 14 swinging strikes. That's a 16.9% rate. That's really, really good.
How many did he walk? Did he walk anybody?
One.
Wow.
And it is the Marlins lineup, and I joked with friends going into the game that, hey, he gets a triple A lineup, but it's sort of like a half triple A lineup. Justin Bour, Starlin Castro, Derek Dietrich, those are guys who, they are major league players. They're going to get lumped in with the rest of this team because the Marlins are just so bad right now. But those are guys who are near the top of the order who Wheeler had to face multiple times. So, if I'm looking to give him credit, there's plenty of the lineup that, like you referred to, the night before, I'm kind of frustrated that DeGrom's not doing what Wheeler did tonight.
Right.
And then Wheeler goes out and does it. And, again, not concerned at all about DeGrom. But it was more just sitting there going, man, shouldn't, what's going on here? Like, why are they making contact at all? That kind of caught up to him and everything. He's going to be just fine. I've learned my lesson years ago now about ever doubting DeGrom. But that was the best you could hope for from Wheeler. And the latest updates finally sound like they're realistic about when Jason Vargas can come back.
Yeah, no more of this 5 days after breaking his bone in his hand.
Just and I wanted them to sign a pitcher. He wasn't my top choice, but I was still glad they did it. This is still a guy who I want to come back and be on the roster.
It's a good problem to have when they're going to have to find innings for all these guys. As long as they manage it well. And it seems like Callaway is capable of doing that, so I'm pretty optimistic about that.
Yeah, and everybody just seems to have bought in. And I know we touched on that a little bit last week too, but you have a new guy at the helm and a few new faces in the clubhouse, and then you start like this, and there's going to be goodwill to go around for a long time.
Yeah, absolutely. It really does feel like there's been a huge cultural shift on the team, and when you look at it, there's a couple of new players, but it's really more or less the same crew from last year. So it just goes to show how much of sort of a tonal shift can happen when you get a big personality in there and a manager that seemingly doesn't hate his players.
Yeah.
I don't.
I'll defend Terry a little bit. I don't think he hated his players.
There were times it felt. Oh, sorry. Hated his non-veteran players.
Yeah. There you go. I'm in a good mood. Everybody's great. I still go back to, spring training. Not to harp on it too much, but it was just walking around the fields and the back fields and the main fields and everything, and having Omar Minaya, Fred Wilpon, Terry Collins, and Ruben Amaro Jr. just around. It was just that is a whole lot of my history of baseball fandom just swirling around the same complex. But anyway.
Yeah. We should probably talk about the couple of little not so great things that are going on right now. Travis d'Arnaud hit the 10-day DL today for a partially torn UCL. There is talk of him possibly needing surgery for it. If that is the case, he will likely miss most, if not all, the season. That's obviously not great news, especially because Kevin Plawecki has not been hitting the ball all that well as of late. And then he himself got hit on the hand today with a pitch, even though the X-rays came back negative, and he seems like he'll be okay. The Mets catching situation is certainly not ideal with one or both of those guys out. They do have Jose Lobaton in the minor leagues, and he is not on the 40-man, but if d'Arnaud is transferred to the 60-day DL, that will open up a spot on the 40-man, and I'm sure if they needed to get him on there, they could find a way. I kind of hope that they maybe don't go with Lobaton. I kind of hope that they either give Tomas Nito a chance, or I meant to look this up before the show, and then I didn't have a chance to. There are, I know, still a fair amount of catchers who did not sign with major league clubs this offseason. So there's probably a couple of people out there who are of similar or slightly better baseball stock than Jose Lobaton. What do you hope they do with the catching situation?
Well, I know at the time it all went down, I think I had checked out who was still out there, and whether or not they are still playing, I'm not entirely sure, but I think it was Carlos Ruiz and AJ Ellis were kind of the two names of guys who are on the older side, but have had success in certain aspects of the game in recent history. I mean, the dream is trade for Real Muto.
Yeah.
That's going to be the popular thing, and I don't know if they have what it takes to get it done and be comfortable with it afterwards. And even if you have to give up something of significance to get him, I know the farm system isn't in like the greatest shape, but the Marlins probably don't necessarily care if a guy's going to be ready in the next year or two.
Yeah.
So if you have to give up something that hurts, but is at the lower levels in the minors, and you can get somebody of that caliber, then that would be my preferred plan A. And yeah, I'm operating under the assumption that Darnell will require Tommy John surgery, which, even for a position player, is going to knock you out for a year. The recovery time's a little bit shorter than a pitcher, but
But you figure he throws more than the average position player is going to be throwing also.
Oh, yeah. Yeah,
So,
absolutely.
it might be longer than if a middle infielder gets TJ surgery.
Right, which TJ Rivera did.
Okay. I was hoping you'd pick up on that. Yeah.
I'm just making sure, you know. I don't want it to be lost on the audience here.
Right. But yeah, you know, it's certainly not ideal, but I also think that we're in a position, I hate when people say we in regards to a team they're fans of, because I am not a Mets employee, I shouldn't say we. But the Mets are in a position right now where if the rest of their offense is clicking, if they have a defense-first catcher, or if you know, Plawecki is calling good game but is only hitting, you know, 210 or something, I can live with that. So I'm not panicking just yet, catching-wise.
Yeah. Yeah, no, and I mean, look, maybe we're surprised. Maybe the outcome for Darno is not as severe, and it's a rehab and come back this season kind of thing. I will say that can be frustrating with a pitcher because you know it's going to be such a long outage. But because a position player may be able to make it back a little bit quicker, it might be easier to be patient with that decision about surgery,
right,
as a fan. So, you know, we'll see. A couple of years ago, I probably would have been more upset about it. And I haven't given up on Geno. I've just kind of accepted, you know, who he is.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a fair way to put it. The other sort of snafu of the season, and you mentioned this already, is that the Mets sent down Brandon Nimmo on Monday to make room for Corey Oswalt, who I believe he got up in the bullpen. I believe he stood up in the bullpen and warmed up a little bit. Did not get into the game.
Yeah, he was going to come in if that game went longer than it did.
Yeah, but then was sent down today to make room for Zach Wheeler. You know, I understand that the Mets want Nimmo to get regular at-bats. I understand that. What I don't understand is why they couldn't look at the current roster and find a way to get him at-bats at the major league level. Because Nimmo is... I mean, first of all, I don't think Nimmo has anything left to prove at AAA. I think he's proven he's a major league caliber player. And he got off to a really hot start this season. I just don't get it.
Yeah, no, I'm right there with you. I think a lot of people were too. It's understandable from the playing time perspective to say, oh, look, you know, he hasn't played much. He's probably not going to play much. But just looking ahead from the time they made the move, I would love to have Nimmo available, even if he's not going to start, which is a separate topic. He probably should start at least one game in a series like the one that's coming up. But when the Nationals come into town for three games, I would love to have Nimmo available to give you that really strong at bat as your first pinch hitter off the bench.
Yeah.
You know, and I just, I hope it doesn't come back to bite them. It's the fact that he has to stay down for 10 days unless somebody gets hurt that gets me, you know?
Yeah.
So I don't know. It's just a weird situation where he, you know, had the best hitting line on the team. And it's all small samples. I get it. But he comes out and he's just phenomenal at the plate. And then he has to go spend some time in the minors. And I assume he's not going to come back any later than the 10-day period that he has to stay down. I just wish that he would be around for that next Nationals series.
Yeah. Yeah, what's a bit frustrating too is that, not frustrating, it's the wrong word. It's actually the opposite of frustrating. I think that the perception that some on the team held, and that I certainly held, was that Adrian Gonzalez was going to crash and burn after the first week of the season. And if that's the case, well, then you give Jay Bruce more bats at first, and then that opens up a spot for Nimmo. But Gonzalez has not been terrible. In fact, he's been pretty good. And so that hurts Nimmo's playing time because a perceived negative turns out to be a positive.
Yeah, I mean, through tonight's game now, he's got just the one home run, but just the one home run was a grand slam that gave the Mets a lead against the Nationals on Sunday. He's driven in eight. He's got five walks, six strikeouts. Anytime your walk and strikeout numbers are close to each other, you're doing something right. And he's hitting 296, 406, 444, which, I think is better than anybody thought he was capable of. And he's going to have to do that for a lot longer than this amount of time to really buy into it. But it's a level of production that is similar to the Adrian Gonzalez of old.
Yeah.
So as long as he is doing that, nobody's going to be calling for Dom Smith to come up or for Gonzalez to be benched, on a regular, semi-permanent basis.
Right.
But I was still encouraged that Bruce, finally took some ground balls at first base, and sounds like he's going to continue doing that. It just seems like that's something that I get all the things that go into it not happening in spring training, but it probably should have. And, not as an insult to Gonzalez, but just, hey, what if,
Right,
early in
yeah.
spring training, Dom Smith is already hurt. And at this point in time, we know he's playing in actual games for Las Vegas and going full tilt. But you have that situation. What if Smith doesn't bounce back from this quad thing as quickly as we hope, and Gonzalez is bad? Wouldn't you want Bruce to be taking those reps, even as an emergency type situation?
Yeah.
Say, freak things happen in baseball. Say Gonzalez and one other infielder get hurt in the same game. You'd probably want Bruce to be able to go play first and have Wilmer Flores slot in at whatever the other position is.
Say Wilmer Flores fouls a ball off his face again somehow.
Right, there
Like
you.
these things happen in baseball.
Yeah, there. I know there are strange, unexpected injuries in plenty of sports, but most of the rest of them are high contact games, I mean, hockey and football, you can't ever be like, "Oh wow, how'd that happen?"
Right,
Like,
exactly.
oh yeah, the guy going as fast as he could into the other guy got hurt. Oh wow, what a shock.
The person who is possibly doing irreparable brain damage to his body right now is getting hurt somehow? How does that happen?
Right.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, it's good to see if Adrian Gonzalez wants to be his 2015 and earlier self. We can all get a nice gigantic apology greeting card together and sign it, because I don't think, I could be wrong. I maybe I'm not the best follower of everybody else in the Mets internet universe, but was anybody saying anything nice about Gonzalez coming into the season?
No, I think the nicest you heard were people saying things not too dissimilar to what we were saying, which is, it costs the Mets almost nothing if he's, if he's even a quarter of the player he was at his prime. This is a smart deal. But I don't think anybody was excited about it. I think everybody basically just was not terribly offended by it, at the best.
Yeah, I was okay with the signing. That was about as good as it got. And you were too. So the show was okay with the signing.
I mean, I was pretty pissed, but I didn't think it was the dumbest thing they'd done all off season or anything like that. That would again be Jose Reyes.
Who still has a zero batting average, right?
I believe so.
Well, let's just fact check that real quick. But I'm pretty sure he had a zero batting average and a sub 100 on base percentage. And yep, that's still true.
I will say maybe that's the one knock on Callaway so far, is that he started Reyes twice already.
Yeah, I don't know what that was about.
The one
Like,
time
what was
he's
it, the weather?
the one time he said he just thought it would be a good matchup. I think it was Strasburg. I think he said, like, oh, it makes sense to me, Reyes against Strasburg. and I don't really know what that means because I don't think Reyes, I mean, maybe I'm wrong. Maybe Reyes has a long history of hitting Strasburg well. Do you remember that?
No, not specifically. And it just kind of feels like we didn't get to see a lot of the years that those two players overlapped.
Right, yeah.
I mean, Strasburg's been around longer than we think at this point. You know, this is like when Harvey came up and was like bursting onto the scene, and Harvey's better was a chant. The better part was about Strasburg. So, you know, it's been a while, but still. Reyes leaves the Mets after the 2011 season, doesn't come back until 16, right?
Yes.
Yeah, right. So you have this pretty long gap and some of Strasburg's best work going on during it. You know, so there's that. We didn't get to see it. And from the things I did see, I don't recall it being particularly notable in one way or the other.
Right. Yeah, it's I don't know what was up with that. I will say that I am better with those weird decisions happening in April than I am in August. Even if, you know, Rosario might more need a day off in August than he does now. It just seemed very odd to me. It seemed like a very, again, to invoke the name of my enemy, it seemed a very Terry Collins move to do.
Ha.
So but I'm happy that that seems to have stopped now.
Oh yeah, for sure.
Rosario's been, you know, he's obviously still chasing the ball more than you'd like him to, but I think he's been a more pleasant surprise offensively than we expected him to be. Would you agree with that so far?
Yeah, and I think my expectations weren't necessarily low, but you had a little bit of noise being made about what he had done in his debut in the major leagues last year. And I forget who it was, but I think it was somebody whose work I respect who had written something about, you know, how worried should we be about Rosario or something, you know, just some sort of thing looking at what he had done. And I get it. You have that spotlight on you because of the prospect status that you had not that long ago. You know?
Yeah. I mean, he was, you know, if you go back, I did the season preview for Rosario. Did I this year?
Sure. I think he did.
I think I wasn't supposed to, but I wound up doing it at the last minute. And so I went back and I was reading what our prospect guys had said about him in the last couple of seasons, and I forgot just how. I mean, people were incredibly high on him, you know, more so than I remembered. Not that they were, you know, saying he was going to be the next insert, you know, great infielder here, but everybody was talking about how he was so dangerous because he was clearly a defensive threat and an offensive threat. And then last season we saw very, very little of the offense, and I didn't expect it to never get there, but I thought, you know, okay, he'll hit a little bit. But if he can cut down on some of the sort of free swinging that he does, especially with two strikes, and they keep batting him in the nine hole a fair amount, I really like that. I'm totally on board with that.
Yeah, and then if he comes around and turns into somebody of that caliber of, I don't want to cast these expectations upon him, but you know, Correa is probably ridiculous, and Lindor maybe also be it could be a ridiculous thing, but somebody who's thrown into the mix with those kind of names, if that naturally happens, I mean, he's so young. So if that happens as he adjusts and all that, then hey, you know, great. He's a top of the middle of the order kind of hitter. Love to have that problem and deal with it when you get there, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. So the one listener email we got, we put out the call for questions tonight on Twitter, and we had one person write in. Who wrote in, Chris? Do you have the name handy?
No, but if I click a few times, I will. Here, ask the question, and then I'll say who said it.
Okay. The question was asked how soon until we're gonna miss, until we're gonna feel Darno's absence or be hurt by Darno's absence. I think it's gonna be sooner than we'd like to admit, but I don't think it's going to be as serious as we're necessarily fearing it will be either. I'm not saying serious in terms of the severity of the injury. I just think that with a team as, here's the magic word again, balanced as this team appears to be, you can lose a player, especially a non-superstar player, for an extended period of time without it being the world's biggest deal. But I think when you're really going to feel it is when Jose Lobaton is getting regular at-bats for this team.
I think so. I don't think it'll be sooner, if only because the overall expectation for Darno wasn't that great. The one thing I'll say is that I had been hopeful based on his home runs and plate appearances last year and some of the power he had shown in the past. This is a guy who I thought could hit maybe 15 to 20 home runs as a half of a playing time platoon,
Yeah.
And that's not nothing. I don't know that they necessarily get that from somebody else right now, but yeah, I mean, right now it feels like, what is pain? What does that feel like as a Met fan,
Yeah.
At some point, like you said, 161-1 is not going to happen. But at some point, they're going to lose a couple games in a row, and maybe during one of those games, whoever is catching has a bad night. That would probably be the first time that you feel it.
And who asked that question, Chris?
The username Simca Weissman on Twitter. At ripped underscore rebel underscore.
Well, we appreciate the question. Thank you very much. A couple last minute things before we get out of here for the night. I want to mention that it's amazing to me that the Mets have not lost a game in division yet. Their one loss happened to come outside the division, which is not a huge deal right now, but will feel big later on. The fact that the Mets have won, is it now 8 games in division? Yeah, I guess 8 games against the Phillies, Marlins, and Nationals. If things are tight later in the season, though, that will make a big difference.
Oh, and going back to 2 episodes ago, who will be the first team the Mets sweep? My answer was the only team they didn't sweep.
Yeah.
I mean, I always feel cheap about calling it a sweep when it's a 2-game series,
Right.
but the Mets did beat the Phillies 2 out of 2 times, so officially that would be the first. But yeah, I said Cardinals, and then they lose one game to them and then sweep everybody else,
Yeah.
so.
And the other thing is, I don't like it because it makes me just feel too optimistic, but when a team goes on a streak like this, and I remember this happening in 2015, you're going to see, give it two, if they win the, if they can somehow sweep the next series against the Brewers, you're going to see a lot of articles saying all the Mets have to do is go blank over the course of the rest of the season and they will wind up in the playoff contention. They're not quite at, they just have to go 500 yet, but they're not, they'll, someone will say if the Mets go, 550 the rest of the season, they will wind up with 90 something wins or whatever the math is. And I don't like that because, like I said, it just makes it look too easy. But the reality is, and I get into this argument with my dad all the time. My dad always says, you want to get hot in August. You don't want to get hot in April. And my answer is no, you want to get hot whenever you can. These wins mean the exact same amount now or at the end of the season.
Absolutely.
In fact, I might even argue they matter more now because they let you then use September as a time to prepare for the playoffs as opposed to a time to fight for your life.
And they help build a case that when July comes around, the front office feels that there's some pressure to make additions.
That is true also.
Wherever they may be, wherever there's a need. Say Darno is out for the season, and they roll with Plawecki, Nito, Lobatone. You get to July and they're in a spot that they're in now, and you go, hey, Real Muto's out there, or even Lucroy is out there, and we can get one of those guys at whatever the market rate is for the two of them. It's a lot easier to have pressure put on the front office to do that if the team is doing as, I mean, if it's doing half as well as it is now.
Yeah. If they're somehow at like 75-5 at the All-Star break,
Yes.
then we'll revisit this conversation. So what's the longest Mets win streak you can remember?
Recency bias may be factoring in here, but it 2015, 11 games for me. I know there have been longer ones, but that is a stark standout in my mind. The other one, did they win 9 in a row on that West Coast trip in 2006, or was it
Yes.
not? It was 9 in a row.
I think so.
Let's just double check. You're probably correct.
Yeah, I was at game maybe like 7 or 8 of that 2015 win streak, and it was a cold April night at Citi Field. I got some s'more crusted bacon. Because I'm an American and I can do what I want to my body. I remember just there was this like buzz in the ballpark that I had never felt in Citi Field before. Because Citi Field to that point had never hosted a winning team. And it was the first time that there was that little bit of a glimpse of, oh, this place could really kick some ass if the team was good. And obviously that season was a lot of fun for a lot of reasons. But that was sort of the beginning of that feeling for me. In the middle of that win streak.
Wait, are we talking about the same year?
The 2015 year, right?
Oh, right. Yeah, sorry. I was mixed up between the 06
No,
West
no, no,
Coast.
no. I went back as you were looking up the 06 one, I just went and talked about 2015 to give you some cover there.
Oh, there we go. Again, how the sausage is made, folks.
Exactly.
06 was 9 out of 10, 8 in a row.
Okay.
All on a West, well, LA, Arizona, Philly.
Okay.
But that was still that 8-game winning streak stood out in my memory.
It's gonna be and the Brewers are not playing very well right now. So the Mets have a chance to extend this win streak by a couple games.
Yeah. And they may get Yelich back, but if so, just for the series finale. And even that isn't definite.
I mean, oh boy. I mean, the fact that they're 10-1 is just insane to me.
Yeah. I was looking back today too, just to see a little bit of the last time there were 8 games over, and it was more recent than I had thought. They got to that point a few times, and I think they had gotten to 9 games over as well at different points of the 2016 season. But they certainly didn't do it last year.
No, they did not. But yeah, we're gonna have some fun, and hopefully we're gonna get some sort of meetup happening later this month or early in May at Citi Field. So.
Yeah. We will try to get that together before, a month slips away.
Yeah. If only just to take in some of these fun games. Have you been out to Citi Field yet?
No, I have not yet. I think my first game, this weekend series against the Brewers, does not work for me for a variety of reasons, all of which are good, but just things going on. Sometime during the National Series, I will be there.
We probably shouldn't talk about this on the air, but I might try and do Monday night if you're interested.
That is the only night of the National Series I cannot do.
Son of a bitch. Okay.
Yeah.
I I will be in Manhattan that day visiting. A friend is in town for a couple days, so I might be hanging out with him in the city. So I thought maybe let's take a train ride over.
Nice.
But we'll see.
Well, don't let me hold you back.
I'm not. Trust me, I'm not. But
Oh, thank you.
no, you know, it would have been fun to catch up with the game, but we'll see.
Yeah.
So I guess before we go, I don't think you and Allison predicted what the next week would look like at the end of last week's podcast. But let's try and guess the Mets record next week, and let's presume we're talking on Wednesday night again next week.
Right, they're coming off, you know, the next two series. I mean, the only fun answer here is 16-1. But let me just be somewhat of a realist and say, how about 14-3?
Yeah, I'll get behind that.
You know, however it happens, you know, just on average, two out of the three in the two series.
I mean, that's going to feel like a letdown, and that's a testament to how crazy the season's been so far. That if they're 14-3 this time next week, we're going to feel like it's a letdown.
Yeah. They lost two games. Who will be the columnist who writes like the Mets have lost twice as many games in the last 6 days as they had all season?
I think we all know the answer to that question. And we're not going to say his name on the show. But he writes for a paper in my home state.
Hi, this is Aaron York for Mason Avenue Audio, and today is quite a glorious day recording on a Wednesday morning, and the Mets are 9-1 after an amazing comeback win over the Marlins last night, in which the ball was just flying out of Marlins Park, and Asdrubal Cabrera hit two home runs as he continues to be a really underrated part of the Mets lineup, and everything is hunky-dory with this team. It's really hard to find something to not be happy about with the way the starting pitching and the bullpen is playing. Even though Jacob deGrom had a little bit of a rough time last night, the Mets were still able to come back because their lineup has been rock solid, and they've been making more contact this year, and they continue to get on base and hit for a little bit of power. And while they don't have, I mean, they have a little bit of star power, but I think what highlights the Mets lineup is the depth. There are tough outs throughout, and a big part of that not only is the way Cabrera is playing, but Adrian Gonzalez. We talk a lot about how Shohei Ohtani is playing so well this year, so amazingly, historically well, after a spring training in which some scouts said he looked like a bust. Adrian Gonzalez, obviously, he doesn't warrant that kind of attention, but he's kind of doing the same thing. He looked like he was still having back issues in spring training after a really terrible 2017 season in which he was held back by those type of injuries. But once we get into the regular season, he looks like he's 100%. He looks like he's back to being that old veteran who's going to be a tough out, and while he might not have the type of power that he used to have or the type of power that he displayed in hitting a super clutch grand slam against Washington, he's still going to be a guy who can move the lineup along and get a base hit when the Mets need it and even play some good defense, as he's looked good on that side of the ball so far as well. So Gonzalez's been a really pleasant surprise considering what he did in spring training, although I was one of the few people in Amazing Avenue Slack room that, not that I get everything right, but that was like, this guy might not be so bad. He's had 10 straight seasons before last year of have a on-base percentage above 340. He is the prototypical professional hitter who just figures out how to get things done, and so far he's looked like that, so hopefully that can continue as well as how the rest of the lineup is hitting, as Yoenis Cespedes, despite being reportedly very ill, comes up with another big hit with the ground ball down the line that ended up being huge last night in the Mets' win. I think this whole thing with Brandon Nimmo, I think he's gonna be up again soon, and I think people are just overreacting to just because of the surprise that he was the guy who went down when the Mets decided to. They brought up Corey Oswalt, but that was really just for one night because they knew Nimmo wasn't going to start against the lefty. So it really is just a Zach Wheeler for Brandon Nimmo exchange, and Nimmo being the odd man out because the outfield now consists of Michael Conforto, Jay Bruce, and Yoenis Cespedes. And while Bruce has resumed taking reps at first base, as we saw on Twitter before the game on Tuesday night, it looks like with Gonzalez playing this well, there's no real need to rush Bruce over there to first base. So right now, the Mets would prefer that Nimmo get at-bats in AAA instead of helping the Major League team off the bench, which does seem like they're sacrificing a little bit of that win-now attitude to develop Nimmo. But this is still a guy, as well as he's played in the Major League in his cup of coffee last year and continuing at the beginning of this year, he's still a pretty inexperienced at the big league level, and it could help them down the stretch because he's certainly gonna play for this team in a big role down the stretch, no matter what, if they continue playing competitively, which thanks to this great boost they've gotten out to, they have a strong chance of playing competitive baseball down the stretch. Nimmo's certainly gonna help them there. The really only question is how long he stays in the minor leagues, and that depends on the health and how well everyone's playing. If you'd like to think if Adrian Gonzalez goes in a slump for a month that they just cut bait and move Bruce down there and bring up Nimmo, but I think Gonzalez is still a really, really good player, and I don't see that necessarily happening. It's probably going to be more injury related as to why Nimmo would get called up, but if everyone's playing well, you know they don't need Nimmo up there right now, and it's great to have him stashed as depth and stashed as the future, because I believe it was Sandy Alderson who said it himself that he's still going to be a really important part of this team's future. It might have been Mickey Callaway, but the point is that the Mets believe in this guy, and they just want to get him some consistent at-bats instead of bringing him up as a pinch hitter once every other game. So I don't have a huge problem with it. I think, honestly, I think it was like Ted Berg said on Twitter that Mets fans just needed something to complain about after winning six straight games, and then they made it their seventh straight game with the win on Tuesday. So hopefully everyone can complain or can calm down about the Nimmo thing, and it will certainly help if the Mets keep winning, as they've got one more against the Marlins this week before they move on and continue their tour through the National League. So, there's a lot to be happy about, whether it's Asdrubal Cabrera hitting a home run from both sides of the plate like he's Carlos Beltran or Chipper Jones, and then Adrian Gonzalez playing like last year didn't happen, and then Brandon Nimmo, it'll work out in the long run for him if he continues with this amazing approach at the plate. He got off to such a hot start, but it was only fewer than 20 plate appearances, so it's not like this guy had like months of production under his belt, but it will hopefully work out for him. This has been Aaron York for Mason Avenue Audio.
Hey everyone, this is Steve Sipa, and the minor league season has finally started, and I'm happy. But since there are only three games last week, and actually Binghamton only played two of them because one of them got postponed due to bad weather, I'm only going to do our first minor league player of the week segment next week. So I went over projected rosters over the last couple of weeks, So now that the season is in full swing, I'm going to do something kind of related. I just want to highlight some of the players that we aren't going to be seeing immediately or at all because of injury. So first up is, let's just start top to bottom. Let's look at Las Vegas first. First guy up is someone that the Mets just recently signed, AJ Griffin. I don't know exactly what's going on, but you'll notice that he has not been assigned to Las Vegas 51s yet. He only threw two innings in spring training. He threw one inning on March 13th, and then 1.1 innings on March 17th, and that was it. And he basically just has disappeared since. During the end of the season last year, PJ Conlon was basically being used out of the bullpen, and they were basically gearing him up for a future role as a reliever, but now he's back in the rotation for Las Vegas. So I'm guessing that the rotation spot that he is currently occupying was originally intended for Griffin. Maybe Griffin isn't hurt. Maybe some other team showed some interest or something like that, and the Mets and him are working something out. I don't know. I don't have any inside information there. But the season started, and who knows when we'll see him on the mound. Catcher Jeff Glenn, he'll be starting his season on the DL. Glenn really hasn't played much, though, and with Jose Lobaton on the team, Glenn really wasn't going to be getting that much playing time to begin with. Another guy that is on the DL and is really not going to be getting that much playing time, even if he was healthy, was Matt Obersty. With Dom Smith down there, you know, Obersty really wasn't going to be seeing much time. When he does come back, he'll be a bat off the bench, I guess, get an occasional start when they want to rest Dom. And he could even cover third base and get some time over there when David Thompson is being rested. But since Phil Evans is back in Las Vegas now, Evans will probably get those bats, so Obersty will really not be seeing too much playing time, I'm betting, this year. The most notable AAA starting his season, most notable AAA player starting his season on the DL, I guess, this year is Kevin Kaczmarski. He's a guy that Keith would probably refer to as a professional hitter. You know, he's been a consistent kind of 275 guy or so for his entire minor league career. He has a kind of simple contact-oriented line drive swing. He's one of those kinds of guys. In the PCL, he'll probably hit like 300 and add a little power, but even factoring that in, he's not really a guy that's being missed, per se. There just really isn't that much upside there. Brendan Nemo, who was sent back down to the minor leagues the other day, he should automatically get penciled into the lineup every night, and so should Bryce Brentz. So that leaves Kaczmarski basically competing with Patrick Biondi, Zach Borenstein, and Matt Dendecker. Honestly, no one in that group has that much more potential or is head and shoulders better than anyone else. So it'll actually be interesting to see how DeFrancesco juggles every. Next up now is Binghamton, AA, the Rumble Ponies, and there's a few guys, one of whom is Jeff McNeil, who has already been placed on the DL. He got into one game, and he went one for three with a homer. And for the past couple of years now, that's basically been his thing. In 2016, he got into three games, he killed the ball, and then he missed the rest of the season. In 2017, he started out the season on the DL. He got into four games at the beginning of the year. He hit 500 with two homers, and then he missed the next 3 months. And, you know, we joke around about how in the past the Mets have had middle infield prospects made of glass that had their careers ended by injuries. I mean, guys like Rhys Havens, Robbie Shields. And it looks like Jeff McNeil is going to be in that list. I know Greg and Lucas still liked him this past offseason when we did our prospect list. But for me, the McNeil ship has sailed, and it sucks because I liked him at one point. But just all the injuries constantly has really delayed his baseball maturation and what he should have done and become at this point. Another Binghamton infielder that's on the DL is Nick Sergakis. He's a guy that's actually surpassed all my expectations of him. In the 65 games he played with St. Lucie last year, he hit 252, 371, 432, which is pretty good for a gritty, Grishny infielder. That's, you know, there really isn't too much potential in there, but he's a fun guy to root for, and he's one of my, you know, quote-unquote guys, but one of the non-prospect ones. On the pitching side for Binghamton, Joshua Torres and Ricky Knapp are both going to be starting the year on the DL. It's easy to forget that Torres exists, but he had a solid year in St. Lucie last year. He was never a big international signing. When you look at his stats, it's not like they jump off the page at you or nothing like that. But he's relievable. He was a reliable reliever last season, and sometimes that's all guys are. Knapp, like McNeil, he was a guy that I was a fan of, but that was a few years ago at this point, and time has passed, and I'm not really sure that he has that much of a upside anymore. I mean, he never had a huge upside to begin with, but I thought that maybe he'd be like one of those pitchers that were able to survive despite lacking a plus anything, because they just had so many different things that they could go to and use during a game. But, I mean, he was hammered in AAA last season, and it's looking more and more like he's just a guy whose talent level is maxed out in AA. Lots of players have been there. Going down now to St. Lucie, Michael Gibbons, Jeff Deal, Jordan Humphreys, and Colby Woodmansey are all starting the season on the DL. Gibbons isn't really an interesting player, and if it wasn't for the fact that he's an outfielder transitioning into being a pitcher, Deal wouldn't be either. Humphreys, we knew that he would be out for the season because he had Tommy John last summer. So basically, Woodmansey is the only guy to be highlighted here. He had hip surgery, and he's going to be out for the season recovering from that. He missed most of last season as well because he had a core injury. So again, now it's two seasons in a row, same like McNeil. And again, we're back to the Mets having fragile infielders again. Woodmansey, you could argue, has the highest upside of all of the middle infielder starters, position players in full season ball for the Mets right now. He has a quick bat, he's a disciplined hitter, he works the count. So he didn't necessarily have the highest upside, but he was a guy that it was exciting to watch because he could develop in a way that he could become a useful player, possibly at the major league level. Now it's going to take another year before he's on the field, and that's another year wasted in his baseball development. Going down to Colombia now, Wagner LaGrange was put on the DL for an undisclosed injury. But once he gets back, he should be getting... It should not be too long before he comes back. And he should be getting regular playing time once he does come back. The Columbia outfield right now is composed of the two Stanford picks from last season, Quinn Brody and Matt Winoker. And then Rafael Gladue, who was the Mets' 16th round pick last season. And I'm not the biggest fan of LaGrange. I know a lot of people are. But he definitely has a bit more upside than Gladue. And he should be getting the playing time when he comes back. There's three guys that have technically not been assigned to Columbia, but if they were healthy, they would have. First one is Colin Holderman. He won't be getting assigned anywhere because he underwent Tommy John surgery. He's a guy that has talent, but who knows what will be left when he's finally able to get back on the field. He pitched 30 innings last year, and then he tore his labrum. He's going to miss all the season this year because of the Tommy John. That's a lot of time he's going to be missing. And, you know, all those injuries and all the surgeries could have a major impact on Colin Holderman, the player. Thomas Zupacki is in the same boat as Holderman. He had Tommy John surgery last season. He also threw 30 innings. And he's going to be missing pretty much all of the 2018 season, I'm assuming. I mean, he might show up in a couple of token innings at the end of the year. But, I mean, he's very talented. Arguably, if he was healthy last year, he could have even been the Mets' number one prospect. So I would assume that the Mets will be a little cautious on this. But then again, who knows what the Mets are doing sometimes? And that kind of segues to this last player who would have been assigned to Columbia. And that guy's David Peterson, who suffered a quote-unquote arm injury near the end of spring training. And he's expected to join Columbia in a week or two. Now, the thing is, I have reason to believe that his arm injury is something that's just a little more than just a little thing holding him up for a couple of weeks. I hope I'm wrong, but that's, like I said, I have a feeling. And the Mets don't exactly have the best track record here. Best case scenario, it is legit just something relatively minor and all's well in a little bit and he goes on, pitches a good season, and all this is put to bed, no issues. But I think that there's something more significant, and I hope that Peterson's season this year isn't wasted by them having him pitch through the injury and then next season is impacted because they delayed a surgery that he could have had immediately out of the gate that instead he's trying to pitch through. So, fingers crossed, knock on wood. There's a couple of guys that haven't been assigned to any teams that could be an extended spring training or could have been hurt, but two guys that we do have confirmation of injuries are Dylan Snipes and Bryce Hutchinson. Snipes had shoulder surgery, and he'll be out for a couple of months. And as a shortstop with a bad arm to begin with, shoulder surgery is not good, so it's not looking good for his baseball career going forward when he's finally able to get back on the field, because a lot of times shoulder surgeries sap arm strength, and his arm strength is not where it should be as a shortstop, so we'll see about him. And finally is Hutchinson, and his injury is a big deal. He's one of my guys, quote-unquote my guys, but he's also going to be good if everything pans out. He was probably my favorite selection in the draft last season overall. You know, Peterson is a more polished pitcher, but, you know, I don't know. I found it a little bland, nothing against him. And Vientos, you know, he has a lot of upside, just like Hutchinson, but I'm always partial to pitchers, so Hutchinson is my favorite pick. Well, we don't want things like season-ending arm surgeries throwing off his baseball development, and that's pretty much what has happened. He's going to be out for the entire season, so that's one season gone. Cameron Plank, he missed the entire season last year, and his stock has fallen a lot because of that. And now the same thing is happening to Hutch. But, you know, Mets, what can I say? So those are some notable guys that are going to be missing from the early season rosters. And next week I'll be back with a happier, more exciting topic, our 2018 Minor League Players of the Week.
That does it for another installment of Amazing Avenue Audio. Thank you so much for listening. Please go to AmazingAvenue.com where you can find all the Mets news and analysis you could possibly need for this new season, as well as updates on the minor leagues, fun stuff like the Mets Mind Boggler. We have a new t-shirt, Salt and Pepper Season. A lot of fun. Pick that up. And everything else Mets related you need is at AmazingAvenue.com. You can also find us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at Amazing Avenue. You can download this show directly from blogtalkradio.com or grab it from Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or the podcatcher of your choice. Please take some time, rate, review, and subscribe to it on Apple Podcasts. Those things help us quite a bit. You can email the show, podcast@AmazingAvenueAudio.com. You can tweet at the show, which is the same as the website, at Amazing Avenue, or you can follow and tweet at our contributors directly. I am at Brian Intanap, Chris is at Chris McShane, Aaron is at Aaron P. York, and Steve is at Steve Saipa. So, as Chris and I said, next week we hope that we're here talking about the 16-1 New York Mets, but even if we're not, we'll still be having some fun, and even if the Mets lose every game between now and then, they'll still have a winning record, which is crazy to say, and hopefully will not happen. I don't believe in jinxes, but I hope I didn't just jinx this. So until next time, let's go Mets. We'll be right back.